Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. This week, I've been cruising down memory lane because I'm writing a new afterword to a new edition of my book, Technosis, which is going to be coming out next year on North Atlantic Press. That book has had a long life, came out in 1998 and stayed in print until just a couple years ago. And then somebody wants to bring it out again, even in hard copy, as well as a long overdue ebook version. I even scoured the torrents and I couldn't find too many floating around, or really any. So it's an exciting time, and for the afterword, I wrote one in 2004 for another edition, and now I'm writing one 10 years after that. And I've been spending a lot more time this time thinking about the matrix of cultural influences that I existed in when I started doing the research for that book in the early 1990s. I really did sort of piecemeal research for a number of years before sitting down and putting it all together, and clearly in a way that seems to continue to inspire people. And so I was thinking about my own inspirations, and particularly a period of American history that I think does not get nearly as much attention as it should, or in some ways it's actually kind of nice that it doesn't get it, because it remains sort of undergroundy. And I'm talking about the early 1990s, or really the late 80s into the 1990s, when there was just so many different forces that were converging, and that if you were tuned into the convergence, there was a lot of magic and marvels to be had. And I'm thinking about the way that the emergence of new technologies, both real, like BBSs and PageMaker on the Macintosh, and other tools of media, and also imagined, or largely imagined, like virtual reality or cyberspace or the coming cyborg, which of course is also sort of real too, given how much human beings have long been enhancing themselves with technology, but the sort of visionary sci-fi cyborg on the horizon. And these tools and technologies not only set in motion what was called sort of cyber culture at the time, a kind of cyberpunk influenced excitement and a celebration, and sometimes kind of nihilistic snark surrounding new tools and the cultural changes that were coming, but they also sort of enlivened a variety of other subcultural currents, many of which were sort of living and percolating in the zine scene in the 1980s, which itself started to go online more and more in the 1990s. So there were threads of psychedelia, of high weirdness, Robert Anton Wilson, paganism, conspiracy theory, weird science, kookery. So it was a wonderful time for subculture. It was a marvelous time where subcultures kind of got amplified, exchanged, interconnected. And in retrospect, it was clear that in some sense it was all a sort of premonition, or a kind of early run-through in these creative margins of American and society for the emergence of the World Wide Web and the subsequent migration of publishing and subculture onto the internet. And so it's been an interesting move. It's both an exuberant and a melancholy operation for me. It was marvelous to go over a lot of this material and to realize how close I was to a lot of really interesting things, and then contemplating sort of where things are today, it becomes a little bit more sobering in some ways, not in all ways, but in some ways. And it so happened, luckily, that my own writing this week has coincided with my reading for this week's guest, who is Gareth Branwyn, who is a mover and shaker in precisely that scene I was describing. And in fact, in many ways, for me, of all the writers and figures of that time, although he continues to do work afterwards, and we'll talk about that, but really cut his teeth in precisely this, the same moment where I was sort of getting my early influences, that he really, he crossed the different elements of it probably more thoroughly and more exuberantly than anyone else I can think of in terms, and you can see it in his new book, Borg Like Me. And it's a collection of essays from the 90s and more recently, as well as a lot of nice copious introductions that help weave them together and set them in motion. And Gareth is a very lively, engaged, passionate, curious writer. And in these pages, you're going to see lots of elements of precisely that cultural mix I was talking about. There are wonderful essays on Jack Parsons and Robert Anton Wilson and personal Borg experiences. There's a hilarious one about a crazy clown that gets on a New York subway and terrorizes the passengers. There's discussion of some of Gareth's own work. I still own the 5.5-inch floppy version of Beyond Cyberpunk, quite influential early HyperCard environment that really gave us a taste for the kinds of interactive environments that we now take for granted. So it's a wonderful book, and I really hope that it gets out there and that people, especially younger people, read it, because, as I mentioned, I feel like this period gets a little bit of a short shrift. People don't quite recognize how influential this scene or this set of scenes was in terms of getting the kind of initial culture of the internet, of digital culture, going. And now, you know, Boing Boing still exists as a wonderful website, but it's just one website among others, another news feed, another stream, and even it is probably not as lively as it once was as people migrate ever more and more onto Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a very important stream, not just historically, but I also believe in terms of keeping alive a certain culture of resistance and anti-authoritarian exuberance and DIY celebration that I think is really key to keeping us motivated and keeping us engaged in what is in some ways a much more challenging digital environment. One more mention just on that DIY side of things is, of course, one of the places that this current has been most lively in the last decade or so has been in the maker scene. And Gareth has been involved in Make Magazine in a variety of capacities, including producing the marvelous and bizarre Maker Faires. And so that's a place where these energies continue to flow and fluctuate. And so we'll be talking to Gareth about that as well. But before we bring him onto the show, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric. Yeah, I was peripherally involved in all that exciting time you're talking about in the 90s. I remember my ex-boyfriend at the time, it was while I was in college that the internet was forming and taking place, and my ex-boyfriend was really good with computers and made friends with a bunch of hackers online through the Cult of the Dead Cow. I don't know if people still remember that website.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then my uncle was like making artificial intelligence and working. He knew people with William Gibson and knew. So I had like these two contingencies of information that I would get that from. I myself can never claim any computer knowledge, but I was a huge sci-fi geek. So, of course, during that time, I read, you know, for whatever people think of it, Snow Crash had, like, a big influence and all those kind of things. So I, much like you, have a, like, emotional, experiential tie to those events as they unfolded. It was incredible, like, to just watch, like, you know, even from a spectator's position, to hear the stories of all the folks involved in generating these realities, whether real or imagined, like you said, I mean, it was mind-opening. It was a lot. It was great.
Well, it's funny. I mean, you say, like, well, as a spectator, but just the fact that you were reading cyberpunk literature, you know, in a way, this world was half imagined. I mean, half of the work that happened occurred in the imagination, and that's probably what I find very inspiring about it. Now, when I look back and I see the naivete, I see things that weren't predictable. I see a certain jejune, you know, leather clad intensity or whatever. But at the same time, I see a place where the imagination and actual tools, techniques, and social organizations came together to really create something that inspired a lot of people and influenced a lot of stuff. So
yeah.
I still see it a very positive thing. So with that all said, Gareth, thanks so much for joining us in Expanding Mind.
Oh, it's totally my pleasure. I'm so happy to be here. I'm a big fan of the show, so I'm glad to be on it.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to remember when we finally met. I mean, we were in touch off and on over the years, and then we met at some point, and I can vividly remember going, it's Gareth. But I think it was in London.
Yeah, we met in 2009 at the Equinox Festival in London.
That's right. That's right. Yep. I have a crap memory for such things. But anyway, congratulations on the book. As I said, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, having done something somewhat similar a few years ago with Nomad Codes, where I went through and, you know, cherry picked a bunch of essays, and I didn't do the extra labor, which is perhaps unfortunate because it's really wonderful to see how you used it in the book of offering these nice introductions to the pieces, putting them into context, talking a little bit about them. But it's a funny process, isn't it? Like going through, turning back and looking at this big, you know, stack or hard drive full of strange documents in different folders, and then, you know, deciding which ones sort of are going to be part of this the story of your life, of a period of history. So it's a funny process, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it was amazing. I mean, I loved it. It was very difficult because I've been largely a tech writer, and so I tend to write about bleeding edge technology, and that's, you know, last year's bleeding edge technology is this year's, you know, high tech paperweight. So there wasn't a lot of that material I could use, and so I had to use things that had a perennial quality to them, and so there was that aspect, and then what I call the lazy man's memoirs is really the whole sort of long-form introductions that put all the pieces in context, and so I had to pick pieces that sort of fit that narrative. I really did try to create a sort of a narrative of my life and what my interests have been and my passions, and so I wrote new essays for the book that sort of filled in some of those gaps. The whole process was fascinating. I don't look back. I don't reminisce a lot. I tend to be someone, I tend to be sort of a futurist. So I tend to look ahead. So looking back at all that stuff and going out and getting all the pictures and looking, I saw Beyond Cyberpunk for the first time at South by Southwest. I spoke at the EFF after party at South by Southwest, and it was a retro cyberpunk theme to the party. And so they built this beautiful retro computer lab, where they had a copy of every computer from the early 90s in there. These beautiful, now they're like these beautiful sort of hallowed antiques, but they had Beyond Cyberpunk on it, which I have not laid eyes on that thing in 15 years easily, and I literally cried when they booted it up, because I had forgotten that my now deceased wife was the voice of Kata Sutra, the little fractal anarchist. Aww. That we borrowed from Boing Boing, that she sort of floats through the stack, as they called it in HyperCard parlance. And she opens up the piece. So when the thing pops up, you know, the first thing I hear is my wife's voice saying, you know, beyond cyberpunk, into the future. And I just broke, and you know, the whole experience of seeing it, and it was so beautiful. I sort of forgotten what just an amazingly cool, strange piece of digital art that was. So that whole process has been amazing. So yeah, putting the whole thing together was a challenge and a great experience, and I'm thrilled that it's finally out. It was
I'm sort of similar to you. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about you know, the different scenes I've been through or the experiences I've gone through, you know, a little bit here and there, whatever. And so it's a strange process, as I say, even now, just sort of reflecting on Technosis at this far removed. It's kind of, you know, and I think it is a really important one. I mean, I don't know, you know, we all sit in different kind of perspectives vis-a-vis the ongoing, you know, transformation of digital society. You know, it can't even call it digital culture anymore. That sounds kind of nice and quaint and contained, and there are elements of that that are part of our world, but of course it's far more pervasive, even insidiously so, these days. But there does seem to be something more than just ancient history to this period. Maybe that's because I was there, maybe it's because you were there. But I'd love to hear, as you were going back, since you don't normally do that, and you were going back and recovering these threads of your life, some of which are very personal. It's a beautiful blend of personal stories and, you know, pieces about technology, pieces about cultural figures of the time. And so part of it's a personal thing, but also going through and kind of getting a sort of revised sense of what was going on in those years. How much do you see that sort of continuing in new forms and fashions, you know, maybe with the maker stuff? And how much do you see, like, that there are some lessons there, some inspiration there that perhaps we could use more of now, given some of the challenges and some of the peculiarities of our current moment?
Yeah. It's really interesting because going back, I mean, I enjoyed rereading the things. I enjoyed and sort of snickered a little bit at my naivete and some of the pieces, like the essay, The Radio Days of Cyberspace, where I talk about VR, like VR is going to happen, you know, any day now. And, you know, and we just like things with Oculus Rift. I mean, VR may be coming, you know, becoming popular now in the way that we imagined it back in the early 90s of this sort of immersive 3D experience. But the thing is, I didn't have a big takeaway with that material, but every single person who has read the book cover to cover that was around during those times, that's their big takeaway. You know, you talked about my passion and the passion that we had in that period and imagining this sort of new world and helping to build this new world and all of that stuff, the original creative impulses that gave rise to the internet and, again, the sort of the culture that we now, you know, cyber culture has just become culture. But everyone has, that's been their takeaway, and it's been exciting to them, the idea that this book and maybe Technosis, when Technosis comes out, I think we're on the beginnings, the sort of initial swell of a wave of nostalgia for that period. And so I think it's really a great, and that I was thinking about that during the book, and then going to South by Southwest, they did this retro cyberpunk thing, and I'm starting to see the word cyberpunk crop up more. I know there's a couple of movies in development, and the sequel to Blade Runner, and I think all of that is part of this sort of wave which will soon break of this interest in that period. And so my book, which is very much about someone who helped architect that time and was, you know, swimming around in the well and all of that, and then the sort of passion that I think I bring to everything that I do, but I think we all had that frontier fervor. It's going to be very exciting to see if that is a dominant takeaway that people have from the book. And then, yeah, anything like one guy, Casey Ray from the Future of Music Coalition, who wrote a piece about it in The Contrary in his blog, was saying that, you know, he thinks this is a really important book in terms of revisiting these conversations about what the internet is actually about, you know, in this day of net neutrality, where the internet is really threatened, the DIY aspects of the internet and the sort of distributed democratization of the internet are really threatened. It's a really good time for us to be thinking about these ideas of what the internet is supposed to really be about. You know, the people who originally helped create it, what were they up to? And so, anyway, I hope my book is a contribution to that conversation.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it too, because I have a resistance to nostalgia. I mean, you mentioned that word, and you know, most people are like, nostalgia, you know, maybe you can enjoy it a little bit. It's like it has a particular kind of flavor, a sort of sweet melancholy or something, because back in the day, blah blah blah. But really, if it's just nostalgia, it's only so useful, it's only so interesting. Where things get interesting is where you can look back and recover elements of previous times that still have fire to them, that are still incendiary, that force new questions and reckonings, even like how have we gotten here? And one of the things that I reminded of reading through your book, you have a number of essays on borging, on cyborging, and you know, we can talk about that. I mean, you've had your own rather grueling opportunities to experience the cyborging of your own body firsthand. But you know, reading that stuff now, it's sort of interesting. It's like going, you know, there was a lot of fear and fascination and some kind of sci-fi exuberance around this idea of augmenting the body and the breakdown of the line between the flesh and the chip, and you know, the sort of cyberpunk vision of all these sort of hacked bodies, et cetera, et cetera. But what's missing from that vision almost always is the sense that we have now, where if I was going to be putting some kind of chip in my body or some kind of augmentation device, that device would be online, and therefore it would be open to surveillance and hacking. The sense that back then there was still this kind of emphasis on the individual and what the individual and the networks of other individuals, borged or not, were able to do, whereas now it feels like all of that stuff is happening within this invisible fishbowl of data collection, data mining, surveillance, observation, big data, consumer profiling. And so there's a sort of sense that the autonomy of the Borg even is kind of lost, at least in the imagination, as we try to figure out what does it mean to be and do as digital citizens of this network that its invisibility, its pervasiveness is much different in some ways than I think we imagined it would be.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think one of the things Donna Haraway, who did the Cyborg Manifesto and wrote that great book, Simian Cyborgs and Women, which was hugely influential to early 90s cyberculture and sort of leather theorism, as Mark Derry called it. sort of postmodern academia at that time. The whole idea that the body, the surface of the body, is this kind of political border war. Like, we need to maintain that authenticity and that individuality, and that's what we're at risk of losing. That the government and corporations and stuff want access, and we're certainly seeing that played out. And on a huge level these days.
Yeah, if we think about how that identity plays, like you said, I mean, you can look at like the existence of avatars and how there is that, like right now all this identity stuff is occurring on the web. And when it first started, I mean, no one would use their real name when they went on the internet. Everybody had like a handle or a marker, and certainly like all the hackers, like there was no, people would literally create the identities. And now the battle on the internet is kind of funny in that sense of like, it used to be where everyone would very much imaginatively be this other thing existing in cyberspace. And now it's like this weird battle of like the actual real reality of your identity versus kind of being able to be free to be your avatar out there.
Yeah, I think the first time that I had a real deep chill, really realized the insidiousness of all of this stuff that I'd been sort of working to bring into the world was seeing the movie Minority Report, when he's walking from one place to another and advertising is completely following him. So when he's walking down a hallway, there's ads tailored to him, and then he gets in a cab and there's ad, the ad continues. And just that sense of, oh God, that's obviously, that's all where this is going. We're just going to be completely mined of all of this, you know, identifying data that can then be, you know, you see it now on Facebook. You go to Amazon and you look at a book, and then you go onto Facebook and boom, there's an ad for the book you were just looking at on the right rail of Facebook. And yeah, I think all that stuff is really insidious and pervasive. And, you know, the thing about the cyberpunk, and I think this still holds true, as long as the internet remains net neutrality remains in effect, there is this ability which is so cogently summarized in the John Gilmore, one of the founders of EFF, that, quote, the internet reads censorship as damage and routes around it. That was like a life-changing thought to me. And I think that we still have that power. I mean, you certainly see it in things like Snowden and the ability of one person to, you know, bring down corporations, to threaten governments. That power is still there. I think insidiously, I think, and this is, I think, some of the stuff that Doug Rushkoff gets into in his latest book, Present Shock, is that idea that we're so busy liking shit on Facebook, you know, that the sort of pacification of this sort of push button selfie existence that we've gotten into, which I just think is just, I'm increasingly starting to think is just a really wrong turn that we've taken in our digital lives. And I think people are starting to realize that as well. I think there is starting to be a certain awareness, a certain backlash to that just deep self-referentiality, these sort of referential loops that we've gotten into. And again, I hope my book and other things of this sort of nostalgic wave of interest in early 90s cyber culture hopefully will get people to think about that. Like, what do we really want to be doing here? And then if we want to change things, how can we apply that disproportional power that individuals actually still do have to make huge changes? You know, how are we going to do that?
Yeah, I really, really, I'm happy to hear you reflect on these things this way. And I mean, I'm thinking now of the, you know, very romantic, very, you know, genre fiction figure in cyberpunk literature, and to some extent in cybercultural, experience. Of the sort of individual, you know, the hacker, the one, the outsider, the edge walker, the gray
Ronin,
market
hustler, like a cyber Ronin,
who's constantly negotiating all of these relationships with different entities. And of course, people do, if you know people who are, you know, deep into, you know, cryptography or alternative currencies, or who are working on you know, understanding how surveillance works, understanding how the net, you know, and people who have the skills to be able to act as powerful hackers in the current environment. That's great, but most of us, certainly including myself, just don't have the oomph for that. And so there's this strange kind of it's a strange sort of a feeling that like when you, like exactly what you were talking about, when you get these ads following you around the net, you know, a simple example of the kind of tracking and the kind of profiling that's that's going on, that you feel, at least I feel, very alienated from my own desire, as if I pursue my desire through eBay, you know, wow, maybe I do want to get some rare psych record from 1972, that part of me, that's part of the way that I explore and affirm myself, my desires, my attractions, my fantasies, my creative urges, then it kind of comes back at me in sort of this sort of nasty way, and I'm like, what is that? What's the point of it anymore? And so there's a certain way in which I think we are being very weirdly programmed, I guess you could say, to accept certain kinds of desiring and connecting online, and really forestalling a lot of alternative ways of desiring and connecting. And I don't know very much what to do about it, but for me, this kind of material at least reminds me of, you know, however fantastic it was in some ways, a different way of desiring and seeking connection through technology.
Yeah. And one thing in your introduction, when you mentioned about the sort of nihilism or whatever of cyberpunk, it really did strike me how utopian cyberpunk, as it leaked into culture, in cyber culture, how really utopian it was. And there was something very positive affirmative about how strangely the fiction was very dystopian and dark, but how it was sort of seen inspired culture, it was very positive. There was something very utopian about it, and boy, you know, I'd certainly love to get back to some of that, because I think we've lost a lot of it. And yeah, I think I had this revelation recently, like right around the time that Doug's book came out. I haven't read Doug's book. I saw him lecture about it online. I was pretty impressed by, you know, the basic premise of it. But I'd been coming to a lot of that thinking myself. And I realized one day on Facebook that the two things, that sort of self-referential, constant selfies and people putting up things because they haven't been liked in a while, and so they have this sense that it's like, wait, no, I need affirmation for every thought I have, every meal I eat, it seems like, every book I read. So that whole thing, I think, is very pernicious. And the other thing, though, is I find myself, because I have 2,000 Facebook friends, and a lot of them are very smart, accomplished, creative, a lot of artists, writers, musicians, you know, journalists, that my Facebook wall is very filtered down, my news feed, to just stuff that's really, really cool. So I have this this sort of self-curated feed that's just like, I will look and I, you know, I've gotten to the point where I will bookmark things like, oh God, I really want to read this essay, but I don't have time, so I'll bookmark that. Oh my God, I want to watch this video or this movie or this whatever. And it's like, it's too much good stuff. And so that becomes its own burden and this own, it's overwhelming. And it just, and you're spending all your time. I'm sitting here supposed to be working. You know, it's very interesting. I worked at Make magazine for 8 years. And so I'd get up, I'd have my work day, I'd be very focused. I wouldn't spend a lot of time goofing around on Facebook and stuff. But now that I'm back to being self-employed, I'm my own boss. And so I would just spend inordinate amounts of time on Facebook generating my own selfies and photographing
like
the food
donuts
I ate
around
for
all
lunch.
The time.
And then going through this long list of, you know, oh my God, Dangerous Minds has this, you know, this Nick Cave video that I've never seen from his first album or, you know, whatever. And that becomes its own very scary thing when, you know, you're spending all that time on Facebook. Facebook is making money on that attention and feeding you the ads from the shit that you looked at on eBay and Amazon. And so anyway, yeah, it's a very scary thing. And at one point I realized it's sort of like we're creating our own matrix. You know, we're, so it's like DIY matrix. We're that dude in the, you know, the bubble. And we're being sort of, you know, our data points are being mined by this system.
That's good. Science fiction, imagination in action. Always good. That's one of the things about the cyber culture period is that thinking directly in terms of science fiction can be very helpful, because I think what happens too often is that we naturalize these things. So it's like, oh, it's normal to be on the face on this sort of global information network trading digital photos of ourselves and, you know, following the lives and accomplishments, or the constructed lives and accomplishments of many people who we don't actually know that very well. No, that's actually kind of weird, but it's not. It's normal. It's not science fiction. It's just the way life is. You're like, no, actually, it is science fiction. Let's think in terms of science fiction, because science fiction always has a critical, or should always have some kind of critical edge to it. But we got to take a break right now, where you're listening to Expanding Mind with Maja Daou and Eric Davis. We're talking with Gareth Branwyn about Borg Like Me, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou talking with Eric Davis and Gareth Branwyn about cyborgs and the internet and his new book, Borg Like Me. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit maybe about what you feel, Gareth, is a good antidote to that loss of internet empowerment through, kind of Roman orgy with the information. Like, I know for me, on Facebook, it's funny because, like you said, like, everyone is so addicted to their likes, and they'll think somehow that feels productive because now they're, like, participating. So, like, if you like a picture showing some kind of terrible human rights violation, how can we fix that problem? Like, what are better solutions for people to take empowerment from things like Facebook instead of just being parasited by it? Like, I know when people have, like, actual petitions, for example, on Facebook, like, people that actually will get organized and be like, here, give $1 to the whales or something like that, like, where it actually becomes like a physical tie-in to the imaginary thing. Like, do you feel like with the internet, is that, do we have to do like some physical stuff too? Or like, what do you, how can we start to make those two worlds come together a little bit?
Yeah, well, that's a great segue to something that I really did want to talk about at this point, which is to sort of counteract some of the sort of negative places where the internet and digital culture have gone. I think one of the very, very positive things is the maker movement. And I think the maker movement is very much tied into the cyberpunk and cyberculture of the early 90s. I mean, a lot of the people who were involved in early 90s cyberculture are now the people who are doing the maker movement, like me and Mark Fraunfelder and all of Rudy Rucker, Bruce Sterling, all of those guys have been in Make, Richard Cadre, all those guys who are hanging out on the well have been part of Make and the Maker movement. And I think really what happened there is we had the tech wreck of the late 90s, and so a lot of word workers, digital workers, were out of work, suddenly out of work. And so practically they became interested in DIY at that point. And then you also had the hacker culture, the Silicon Valley hacker culture. When microcontrollers became cheap enough, they became interested in actually hacking hardware and not just software. And I think a lot of that came out of a sort of a corrective to the kind of hyper mentality of cyberpunk. That cyberpunk, you know, Eric, you're talking about the individualism of cyberpunk and the whole, you know, Case and Neuromancer is the, you know, he's a data cowboy and he denigrates his body. You know, the body is the meat and he doesn't really care about it, and he abuses it, and because it's all about being in the network, being in cyberspace. And I think a lot of us sort of bought into that idea. And I think the maker movement, which is very much about physical stuff, about hacking the rest of the world, not just hacking your computer or whatever, but hacking everything in your life, knowing how it works, and figuring out how to improve it, how to make it yourself. And so I think the maker movement very much has grown out of that. I think another aspect of that is the cheapening of these things like microcontrollers and new materials that are inexpensive and you know, do amazing things, and things like 3D printing and laser cutting and CNC. And all of those technologies have created this maker movement. And one of the things that Mark Fraunfelder pointed out, Mark from Boing pointed out to me at one point, is he felt like when the hacker culture, cyber culture, was hacking software to share your software, you just send an email link or you send the software to your friend or whatever, you FTP it. But once we started making physical stuff, hacking physical stuff, you have to get together to show people that stuff. So
right.
That's where you start having hacker spaces and maker spaces and maker fairs. It's just a big orgy of getting a bunch of nerds together who have created these really amazing physical objects, and they show each other. So
right.
I think that's a very, very positive movement. You know, now the thing is that movement is really breaking into the mainstream. The White House just had a maker fair. So once you get to that level of mainstream saturation, where does it go? How does it get co-opted? Things that are underground movements that break that big tend to get sort of declawed and commoditized and commodified. So I think the maker movement's in that point right now. And that's one of the things I've been doing. I'm a research fellow at George Mason University now, and I've been researching this, the whole history of DIY movements of the 20th century. What were their sort of utopian pronouncements in the beginning? Where did they go? How did they get sort of like integrated or commodified or whatever, or diluted? So I'm interested in the maker movement, and I think it's a really interesting time to look at the maker movement because it's right on the verge of sort of total mainstream acceptance.
So that's one aspect of the research, you know, and you just recently stepped down from Make Magazine, and you're doing this kind of research. But in your own life, since you've always been at least a media maker, someone who was, you know, early on grabbing all of the variety of tools you could to make your zines and your HyperCard stacks and to, you know, support other people's media efforts, et cetera, et cetera. Where does that spirit manifest itself in your life now? In what way are you continuing to be a maker yourself?
Well, the one main way is this book. I crowdfunded the book. You know, this is my eighth book. I didn't need to go a DIY route. As soon as I said that I had left Make, I immediately got approached from a publisher saying, you know, hey, if you want to do a book, and I said, well, I'm doing this book. I described the book. I said, oh yeah, no, we'll look at that. And I said, yeah, no, you know, I think I just want to try the experiment of crowdfunding the book, self-publishing the book, print the book on demand, create my own press. I have an imprint called Sparks of Fire Press, sparksoffirepress.com. This is my first book. I also did a couple of chat books during the course of the book. I released a couple of sort of teaser books, chat books. I have one called Gareth's Tips on Sucks Less Writing, which was something that I produced during the early days of the blog movement to give new writers tips from an expert, from a long-term writer. And I did another chat book called Tears in the Rain, a couple of essays from the book. So all of that has been this sort of grand experiment to me. Like, okay, I don't need to go this route. I could, I'm a successful author already, but is this more gratifying to do it this way? Do I make less money, more money? It's all been this big experiment. And it's been the crowdfunding thing was I describe it as sort of grabbing onto the tail of a comet. It's just like I don't know if you either of you have done a crowdfunding project, but it's insane. It's totally insane, but it's fun, it's gratifying, it's nerve-wracking. But that part of the experiment, you know, is done. Now the book is out. I don't know how the book will sell. I don't know. You know, it's a sort of thing where you make so much more money per copy that if you do at least modestly well in terms of units sold, you do really well. So that part of the experiment remains to be realized. But I'm really excited to be doing my own press, my own imprint. I'm coming out with a line of rubber stamps now. I've always been interested. And again, I think all that's coming back too. Interest in zines seems to be on the rise. Mail art, I'm going to launch a mail art project soon. I used to be really involved in mail art in the late 80s and early 90s. So all of that is stuff that I've done robot stuff. Like I just wrote a chapter for a book. Ghost wrote a chapter for a book last week on robots. I still dabble in robots, but not really that much. As I say in the introduction to my book, I'm not really a tech person. I'm not really a geek. I play one in cyberspace. I'm like way more interested in, you know, William Blake poetry and spirituality and, you know, exploring all of these different meditation techniques and stuff.
I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, for me, especially with technosis and all that, cyberculture was always an excuse and an opportunity to think about mutant forms of spirituality, of magic, of weird religion. And you've had that thread as well. You were a teen witch. Some of the pieces in the book are about Jack Parsons, and you talk about Crowley and Robert Anton Wilson, et cetera, et cetera. And you mentioned you have a couple of acerbic things about the New Age and how most of it's just hooey. But I get the sense you've continued your own sort of seeking or exploration in that zone, and now again from this sort of retrospective perspective. Where are you at with that stuff? Where do you see things happening? Is there stuff happening culturally that you're interested in, or personally? What have you made new discoveries, or have you just found what works for you and kind of stayed in that zone?
Yeah, I've been a seeker my whole life. I mean, from the time I was a teen, I've been asking the Buddha questions from a very early age, and I've never stopped asking those questions. I went through a period of my life in the early 90s where I was very much, I mean, I've never been an atheist. I don't know how you can be certain that there isn't a God, but I've always been some stripe of agnostic. And during the 90s, I was way more sort of stridently anti, anything overtly spiritual or whatever. Again, to me, that was kind of a corrective because I was so immersed in that stuff in my youth. I saw a lot of bullshit in it, and I didn't really get a lot of, sort of results that had any sort of real meaning to me, except for meditation. I always found meditation to be amazing and effective, and I still do. But in terms of like the magic and Wicca stuff, I didn't really get a lot of positive stuff out of that in terms of like results-based stuff. And so, but I've always been, Robert Anton Wilson is the through line to my life. I read the Illuminatus trilogy, I think when I was like 17 years old, and so many things have changed. I've never not been in love with that guy. And that sort of, open to anything but skeptical of everything has always informed what I do. And so like my interest in spirituality is always informed by that idea. And also his idea of sort of multi-modal agnosticism. I'm not just agnostic about religion. I'm agnostic about everything. I'm always questioning everything. I think it's all amazing, as like I look at different religious beliefs and stuff, and it's just, it's an amazing form of human expression. I don't know how much of it I subscribe to or whatever, but I'm respectful and I'm respectably skeptical. So like in my book, the Why I Hate the New Age piece, which you referred to, I was just so overcome. The whole Zippy movement just really rubbed me the wrong way. And so I wrote that sort of rant in Boing Boing, which, well, reading it now, it was a little overly, you know, strident and cynical and stuff. I wouldn't write that essay today, but I decided to include it because I still get kind of a kick out of it. But,
yeah, it's still very interesting stuff, and it's also interesting to think about how it too is continuing to change. A couple of weeks ago, we had on Mikey Siegel, who's sort of kind of constructing a kind of technological maker discourse around consciousness hacking. And that's a very interesting thing to think about in terms of a lot of the threads we've talked about today, just the way in which people are going to take cheap, available...
Final 45 time.
Technology, EEG, sensors, low voltage brain stimulators, and just start seeing what happens. You know, and it's, in a way, it's kind of like the next phase of a sort of, you know, on the one hand, it's hacker, and on another hand, it's there's a kind of spiritual element to it, or can be, at least for him, there is. And so it's these patterns do keep recurring in a Batesonian way.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think that's very exciting. You talk about, you know, what's sort of new in that realm. And that all, I wrote this piece for Mondo, I think it was Mondo issue 4, which was called The Desire to be Wired, which was all about the sort of brain hackers at the time, which was all very scary stuff. You know, they're hooking up, high-powered magnets to their head and stuff. It was all very, very crude technology at the time. But yeah, now the technology is starting to become really readily available. It's cheap. And so I'm very excited to see what sort of things people can do for, sort of understanding the nature of how the brain works and the possibility of being able to hack the brain to get into meditative states or whatever. I think it's all very exciting stuff. And again, that whole idea of it being distributed over the internet, you know, we're sort of denigrating a lot of aspects of modern internet culture. But one of the things that, and I think has been a real driver in the maker movement, is the sense that you can go online, and if you have a project you're working on, you can post it, you can get feedback from people, other people improve on your project. That ability to sort of crowdsource development and innovation in any area, but certainly in terms of these spiritual technologies, was really interesting to me. So,
absolutely. Just the learning alone, just the ability to learn, you know, any kind of problem you have, to dig a little bit and you just commit yourself and you can learn. So that's an extraordinary opportunity as well. And I'm interested to see also for me, the consciousness hacking situation also raises in a very direct way, I think, something that's been floating throughout the conversation, which is this question of value, of like, what are the values? Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you posting a selfie? Why are you spending, you know, what is that further value about your life? And that's one of the things that animates your work, is that you're aware of values, you're playing with values, you're celebrating values, and that adds something more than just hedonism or just curiosity. There's some kind of question of like, what is the good? What's worth doing? And the conscious hacking is very interesting, because on the one hand, you can say, oh, great, this is going to allow us to make ourselves more efficient, better producers, better able to deal with the situations of 21st century capitalism, to get ahead, to manifest our da-da-da, that stuff. But at the same time, it's also like, well, who are we? What is the mind? What does it mean to be conscious? Am I my body? Am I, you know, all these other sort of more spiritual or at least consciousness-oriented questions, they also arise. And it's like, once again, here we are wrestling with values in the context of new technologies and creating culture out of those struggles.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, one of the things I was thinking about recently is, in the early days of cyber culture, there was always this sense of, amongst my friends, of, and we'd use the phrase, accelerate the montage, like multitasking, like how much can you actually deal with at the same time? And that was all very exciting when that wasn't as pervasive as it is now, where you see people like at a dinner and everyone's got their phone out, or, you know, they're all into this, you know, again, this sort of self-referentiality. Back then, we were thinking about how can I become sort of more powerful as a person and my ability to process information stuff. But we didn't think about, well, how is this actually going to be used? What's the, as you say, what's the value of this? And the value is not really for the individual. The value is for these data miners and people who are trying to, you know, use that engagement, that attention to their own benefit. And so, yeah, once you start asking those sorts of questions, you have very different feelings about what's happening today than you know, what we did back in the 90s.
So we just got a couple minutes here. I'm curious, what other, do you have other events or things planned around the book?
Yeah, a few things. I'm going to wait until the fall to do a little book tour. You know, this is a terrible time to release a book. No one buys books in July and August. So I'm going to wait until people are more in the book buying mood. And then I'm going to go and do a tour of, you know, do a couple of venues in D.C., Baltimore, New York, Rhode Island, Boston, and then San Francisco. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to do one of those Ask Me Anything on Reddit. I don't know when I'll do that, but I'm going to do that. And I want to figure out a way, again, and this whole thing of it being sort of DIY and trying to figure out ways of making this experiment happen. I want to figure out a way to make the tour be sort of bigger than the tour itself, like to get attention to it on the internet and I want to do interesting things in the tour. I want to visit venues that aren't bookstores. I want to go to hacker spaces and museums and art galleries and other places. And I don't know, I'm still sort of figuring that out, but I want to do something creative and interesting with the tour, which will hopefully make it its own thing, because obviously the more eyeballs I get, the better in terms of selling the book. So
that's good. Well, it seems like there's all sorts of ways you can, you know, play with your fan base. Maybe you stay in, you know, you do it out of people's homes or stuff and record it. I mean, there's so many interesting ways that people are interacting
exactly,
and moving outside of those spaces. So, well, once again, congratulations on Borg Like Me.
And, thank you so much.
And good luck with your further doings. I look forward to seeing what you make out of your post-make zone.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's so great to be on the show, you guys.
Great. All right. Thanks. Well, from me and Maj, to all you out there, keep your minds open.